Hello, and welcome to the ToxPod. Today we're having a chat with another winner of the Alden Currie Award, TF's most prestigious award which honours TF members with a long history of distinguished contributions to forensic tox. Today we're speaking with Brian Finkel. He received the Alden Currie Award in 2018 and was TF president from 1975 to 77. He is one of the originals, a founding member of TF. That means he was literally present at TF's very first meeting in 1963. Even after 60 years, he continues to support the development of our science and our scientists through the Brian Finkel Visiting Science Grant. And as a probably inadequate overview of an amazing career, he started at Scotland Yard as a toxicologist in the late 1950s, travelled to the United States, where he held a number of leadership positions in several toxicology facilities and biotechnology companies over a long period. He spent over 50 years in research in various areas of tox, including postmortem tox, problems with alcohol and drugs, development of new drugs and drug products, and was a pioneer in sports medicine. He spent 30 years as NFL's chief consulting toxicologist, and his founding work in the sports medicine research and testing laboratory in Salt Lake City led to the naming of its new laboratory, the Brian Finkel Building. Besides a Currie Award, he's received numerous prestigious awards for his contributions in toxicology over his career, including the GDFCH's STAS Prize, American Academy of Sciences' Rolla Hager Award, and the National Safety Council's Borkenstein Award. He retired only a few years ago, but is still involved as a special advisor to the board of the Sports Medicine Research and Testing Laboratory. Dr. Finkel, thank you very much for joining the ToxPod.
It's my privilege. Thank you, Peter.
Now, part of these interviews, we like to discuss Alden Currie a little bit, and having known and worked with him in various ways, can we start off with you telling us a little bit about Alden? How did you meet him?
Well, it's not true to say I met him, but we had contact. I was, as you've said, in the toxicology group at Scotland Yard, and there were just three of us, Michael Moss and John Jackson, and I formed the forensic toxicology group at Scotland Yard. And Alan at the time was a forensic scientist, but a toxicologist at the lab in Harrogate in North Yorkshire. And John Jackson and he were trading over the phone mostly collaborative information on chromatography. In those days, believe it or not, we're talking about 1958, somewhere in there, paper chromatography. And the drug group of great concern were the barbiturates. And John had developed eluting solvents, and it was an overnight elution. Alan, at one point, did overnight runs at his home in the bathtub. I mean, this is why Alan is such a character. But we traded techniques for identifying barbiturates and then ultimately the narcotic alkaloids by paper chromatography. And as time went on, Alan was the first one, to my knowledge, in the UK to suggest we get involved in thin layer chromatography. And that was another point of collaboration. And then along came 1963, and I actually met him at the meeting, I think for the first time in person. But after that, we met many, many times through TF, and we became personal friends long after I went to the United States. And we never published together, although John Jackson and I did several times. But we really became friends, Alan and I. And I might say that Alan was supported extraordinarily by his wife, Venice. She was a noted clinical chemist in her own right and also quite a character. But that's how I first made contact and vice versa. In those days, collaboration between the laboratory scientists in the forensic science network of labs in the UK was not encouraged. Many of the directors were jealous of each other. There was professional antagonisms. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Trihorn, who was Alan's boss, was a tyrant. And my boss at New Scotland Yard, Nichols, was also a tyrant. And so John and I had techniques for getting around this and being able to talk with Alan.
It doesn't sound like a very encouraging environment in which to share information. And given TF's priority of sharing as much information as possible between scientists, that's certainly a contrast. Now, I mentioned you were a founding member of TF, and you actually wrote a chapter in TF's 50th anniversary book, which was compiled by Alan Vastrata, which anyone can download that if you're a member of TF. It's in the documents section. Can you set the scene for us for the formation of TF in 1963? It reads to me like there was a bit of a revolt by the forensic toxicologists of the day. Is that right?
It is right, but revolt may be a little strong. There was resentment. The international forensic toxicology medicine community was dominated by forensic pathologists. Mm. And at that time, toxicologists were viewed by them in their post-mortem investigations as just one arm of their technical investigation. The pathologist did the autopsy. They had investigators, usually police, investigate the scene and gather evidence. And they had toxicologists who did the analysis. And that's where it began and end. And we knew, and Alan in particular promulgated this, that forensic toxicology was a science specialty of its own, that combined analytical chemistry techniques with pharmacological interpretation of analytical data. And we were really not pushed, but were seen as just second rate to the pathologists. Mm. And it just wasn't true. So in London, the program in April 1963 for the international meeting did not reflect the contributions of toxicology. And there was resentment about the we had not been asked at all to help organize the agenda. And so Alan Kerry and George Clark took it upon themselves. They were the leaders of the revolt, as you called it, to gather a number of toxicologists who were at the meeting. And I remember I was very young, and it was my first international meeting of any kind. And I was there with John Jackson. So Alan and George Clark got this group together and proposed that we form an organization, the purpose of which would be to exchange, to communicate, to exchange information scientifically, to help each other, and to promote through the organization internationally forensic toxicology as a independent, if you will, science. And it has, of course, been enormously successful. But I would say that of all Alan's accomplishments, of which there are many, his leadership and ultimately his presidency, which I think he had for 6 years, I followed him as president, was really, for me, his massive contribution to our science. I mean, he created the Aldermaston Laboratory, Central Laboratory for Research in Forensic Science in England. He was the UK Home Office Director of Forensic Science. By the way, he and I shared something which continued until the parting of the ways. That was, how do you specifically identify a poison or an extract from human organs? And secondly, how do you apply stringent rules of quantitative analytical chemistry to these crude extracts? And he and I talked about this a lot. And in the very early days, sensitivity was a great problem. The amount of available drug in these organs was very, very small. And our methods of identifying or even noticing their presence were crude by definition. We're talking about milligrams and micrograms. Today, we just take for granted picograms. We would start with 400 grams of liver tissue to extract enough in order to have something to identify. And then so the specific identification, I mean, for many, many years, we identified things by saying, well, we did chromatography and it's not this and it's not that and it's not the other thing. So it must be this.
Right.
It was not a positive specific. Even gas chromatography and liquid chromatography and so on, they were still exclusionary techniques. And many had cross interferences. When immunoassays came along, they weren't specific. They might be specific for a group. So it was a huge problem. So sensitivity, applying stringent quantitative analytical rules to your analysis, was very much in the forefront of Alan's thinking. And I would say in the forefront of very few other forensic toxicologists at the time, though it had fascinated me and continued to fascinate me until I got into mass spectrometry in the early days.
So another person that's often mentioned, and we will know him from Clark's analysis of drugs and poisons, was George Clark. Where was he in toxicology at that time?
Well, really not in forensic toxicology at all, I believe. He was in the veterinary college, and he had a pharmaceutical chemistry background, but he was interested in the biology of toxicology. But he was never, to my knowledge, involved in everyday work as a forensic toxicologist. But that does not diminish at all his contribution. As I say, he really was the co-leader with Alan in the formation of TEFT.
So you started in Scotland Yard in London, working in forensic toxicology, I assume?
No, I was 20 years old, very young, and I was taken on as a junior trainee, so to speak. And at that time, Nichols, our boss, insisted that everybody rotate through the various specialties of forensic science, and which I did, and it could have taken 7 years. But after about 4 years, it became apparent to both me and my boss that my leanings and perhaps skills were in the analytical chemistry and biology of toxicology. And he suggested that I join John Jackson and Mike Moss, who were then just a group of two.
Wow.
So just having two people doing all the forensic toxicology for not only Greater London, but for an area that's stretched from Bournemouth in the south coast in an arc up through Oxford and over as far as Ipswich in Suffolk, and then down the east coast and along the Kent coast. It was a very large segment of the UK. But Mike Moss and John Jackson were doing their best, and I joined them. And the rest is history, as they say.
How did you end up in America?
That's interesting, because it all happened at that meeting in April 1963. John Jackson and I made a presentation which interested some of the Americans. And two of them, Irving Sunshine in Cleveland and Laura Bradford in San Jose, California, and to a lesser extent, June Jones in the state of Georgia in Atlanta, said to me, would I like to come to the United States? And of course, to me, this was fantasy land. And I said, well, how on earth could that be possible? And both Laura Bradford and Brad, as he was known, and Irving Sunshine said to me, well, we have some money and we'd like you to come because it was the beginnings of gas chromatography.
Right.
And we at the yard were starting to use it. And they said, you can come and bring your knowledge and techniques of gas chromatography to help us. Well, Sunshine was the one that had the money. He had a research grant from the NIH, and which he said he could pay me. Well, that was the nice invitation. But I had to go to my Martinet boss, Nichols, and say to him, would you allow me to go on a visit, professional visit, to the United States? And he was, I don't know. You know, that could be. And I said, well, I don't want to give up my job here. But if I went away, say, for a year and a half, and I could bring back good information and perhaps help us, you know, would that be allowed? And he said, well, write up a proposal, brief, and I'll take it to the Home Office. And the director of civil service will have to sign off on it. Anyway, to my absolute amazement, they signed off on it.
Wow.
So in 3 weeks, I had a green card. I got in an airplane and flew to New York, took a Greyhound bus to Cleveland, and went to Irving Sunshine's lab.
Fantastic.
So I was there for 10 months, and I chose not to stay any longer. But then I bought a secondhand Buick station wagon and drove across America to California to Laura Bradford's lab. And that was night and day. And I was there for a year. But his lab was a full-service forensic science lab and was doing very little toxicology, which is why he wanted to support my visit. Because the county, Santa Clara County, which stretched from Stanford University, Palo Alto in the north, all the way to Salinas and the Monterey Peninsula in the south, was very demographically diverse. And they had a coroner system. But right before I got there, they were in the transition to a professional medical examiner system and had brought into the county a board-certified forensic pathologist to take that job. But he needed a laboratory. And so they put me actually on the payroll, the county payroll, while I was there to allow me to design and put in place at least the structure and rudiments of a forensic toxicology lab as part of Bradford's lab to serve the medical examiner. And that I did, and had a lot of fun. The medical examiner wasn't the easiest person in the world, but that wasn't new. The forensic pathologists we worked with in London were prima donnas, and so that was nothing new to me. Anyway, at the end of that time, I went back to England, and I didn't care for what I'd returned. I still loved working with Jackson and Moss, but nobody was terribly interested in all the information I brought back. Nothing got really done. I felt in many ways that toxicology in California was way ahead of where we were at that time. And on a personal level, commuting and living in London it wasn't attractive at all. I had a car, I lived in Sunshine, you know, it was a totally different environment. I always loved London and everything it had to offer, but nice place to visit, terrible place to live.
So at this stage, you would have been in your mid to late 20s, I suppose. Quite a young age to have such enormous opportunities.
Exactly. And I recognized that. And what happened was I got a letter from Laura Bradford in California, and said that the toxicology program that I had designed and set up, the county had decided to create a position of chief forensic toxicologist to the county. And would I like to come back and take that position? And so anyway, to cut a long story short, sold up everything I had, cash and insurance policy, and traveled around the world and arrived by freighter from Honolulu in San Francisco, where Brad met me. I might say that my first time when I went to Cleveland in November the 1st was 3 weeks before President Kennedy was assassinated.
Right.
And it is hard to overstate the enormous political and social effect that assassination had. And it was very tumultuous time. And then when I returned to California in 1964 to take the permanent job, it was just the beginning of the first real wave of substance abuse problems.
Right.
And the hippie culture and so on. So there were a lot of challenges there. But that's how I came to the United States, and I've never left.
To me, it sounds like a story of grasping opportunities as they arise and don't look back and just go for it. It sounds fantastic.
Well, it is. I might say in response to that, I've always had a powerful dislike of opportunism, where I've seen people jump from one thing to another because they thought, for whatever reasons, it was going to be of personal benefit. On the other hand, the recognition of opportunity within the confines of your profession, I've always viewed myself as a scientist. And everything I've done in my varied career has followed a common thread of science. And the bedrock has been forensic science. And so you're quite right. I've had several opportunities, major opportunities, and I've taken them, but it has not been at the cost of my profession as a scientist.
So your career has taken a few interesting turns, as we've already heard, but your contribution to anti-doping was a significant part of your professional life. How did you get started in that field?
Well, there was a huge piece of my life between what we've already discussed and my entrance into anti-doping. And that was my life at Genentech in recombinant molecular biology. And because in 1990, I was, to use the cliche, burned out from my life at Genentech. And I was going to retire or maybe do a little consulting work. But I got a phone call right out of the blue from the National Football League. And the person who called me said, we need help to design a substance abuse and performance enhancing drug, a prevention program, a testing program, and however it should be constructed. So would you come to New York and give us a talk and tell us how we should do this? Which I did. So the result of that was that I was brought on board as their consulting permanent. And it was approved by the union, the National Football League Players Association. It was a joint appointment. They had agreed for different motives. Their motives was the health and welfare of the athletes. So I and two physicians got together and designed a program for them, which then expanded into a clinical arm for treatment and rehab. And so a fourth physician came, a third physician. So my job was to design the program for all the necessary testing and to see that the testing was done by competent laboratories, interpret the results, testify at appeal hearings, and generally support and promote the program. And that's what I did. And I remember asking them, well, how much of my time do you think this is going to take? And they said, oh, I don't know, maybe equivalent of a couple of days a week at the most. Well, you can imagine. It became almost a... So for a long time, that program was my entrance until the year 2000. And in the year 2000, the International Olympic Committee was in sad shape. They were under a lot of criticism. By the way, I had met at the IOC prior to the Sydney, Australia Olympic Games, forensic toxicologists from Australia, and they were terrific. They came to Lausanne in Switzerland and gave a presentation about what they were going to do at the Sydney Games. And at that time, erythropoietin, EPO, was just coming into focus and a very difficult drug to identify its use. And they had a very interesting presentation on how it could be included for the first time in Olympic testing in Sydney. And it was controversial. The vote was split. I voted with them and gave a strong support. And as a result of that, made friends, more friends who were at TF. So anyway, in the year 2000, the World Anti-Doping Agency was created, supposedly as an independent agency from the IOC to oversee all Olympic and international sporting events from a standpoint of controlling, preventing, and detecting anti-doping. As part of their creation, every nation that was part of the Olympic movement had to set up a national anti-doping organization, a NADO. The United States set up in Colorado Springs the United States Anti-Doping Agency. Now, at that time, the United States had two laboratories capable of doing that work. One at UCLA under the direction of Don Catlin, and for a long time, a laboratory at the University of Indiana in Indianapolis under the direction of Dr. Larry Bowers, who was a good colleague and friend of mine. And what happened was that the lab in Indiana got closed summarily. That's another story. And Larry Bowers was out of a job. But USADA hired him as their chief scientist. But people like the NFL and other sports that were beginning to have testing programs were worried the United States only had one lab. What happened? What would happen if UCLA was to pull the rug out from under Catlin's lab, just like Indiana did? We'd be in a terrible mess. So USADA and the NFL in particular, later in Major League Baseball, decided that we should have a second lab in the United States. And they hadn't a clue, of course. And they thought, oh, in 6 months, we can put up enough money and Finkel and Bowers will create a new lab, we'll get it staffed and we'll be on our way. Well, of course, nothing could be as simple as that. And it took 5 years. But what happened was Larry Bowers and I had to find a site where we could start the development of the lab. And it turned out that my Center for Human Toxicology, which I was no longer associated with in Utah, the university, had the ideal setup for setting up a section where we could start developing the necessary methods and so on. And the Winter Olympic Games had been held in Salt Lake, and the Salt Lake Olympic Committee made a lot of money. The United States always managed to make money, and they've made money out of the Olympic Games. So they had a lot of money, and the question is, what were they going to do with it? And they decided they were going to give quite a portion of it to the university. So the university said, if you bring the work of developing a new anti-doping laboratory to the university, we will contract and put in $1 million to help you get started. So those were the three organizations that catalyzed the beginnings of the Sports Medicine Research and Testing Lab. But the lab had to be eventually certified by WADA. You know, it's people laugh, but it's a very difficult business, starting with nothing and creating a lab of international repute and reputation. but it happened. And when the time of the contract with the university was up, then we leased a building on Research Park at the university campus, and we were there until we outgrew all that and had to find where to go. And we decided to build a building. It, funnily enough, it was COVID. We were due to open it in March of 2019, and COVID was just getting going, and we squeaked in February. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to move. And now that laboratory is preeminent, amongst the preeminent labs in the world. And it's more like an institute. We do publish research into all manner of aspects of new methods, keeping up with new doping agencies and practices and so on. And then we provide the services to, I don't know, maybe 20 different sports, including the Olympics and Major League, Minor League Baseball, hockey, basketball, and football, and the NFL are the big ones. But UFC and many other sports, triathlons, and we do all that testing. Sure. And then we have a doctoral and postdoctoral fellowship program, and we bring people in and educate them. And some of them go into forensic toxicology laboratories generally, okay. But some stay in the anti-doping world. So that's how I got into anti-doping. And I was supposed to be retired. And 28 years later, I did retire, but I had another 28 years of professional forensic toxicology devoted to the specialty of anti-doping. Yeah. And it's been fantastic.
You must be very proud of those institutes you helped set up.
I am, really. It's a bit self-serving, and I was totally opposed to my name being put on the building. But the board of directors insisted the alternative was to have some sculpture put in the vestibule of the building, and I wasn't going to do that. But they wanted to recognize, because what happened with Larry Bowers, my partner in setting it up, USADA eventually decided very early on, after the lab was started, not where it is now, but after a few years, that he had a conflict of interest, because we were, the lab that he was partly directing was actually doing the testing for his organization that was paying him. Yeah. So he had to leave. So for about 15 years, it was just me.
Now, you mentioned a bit earlier, we missed quite a large chunk of your career. So let's go back to talk about when you started to get involved in biotechnology company called, you mentioned Genentech. How did that come about? Was that another opportunity that arose that you
seized? I've always thought of me by accident. I've been sort of a 10-year man. I was 7 or 8 years at Scotland Yard. I was 10 years in San Jose, California. And I had become close colleagues with several forensic pathologists. I had made it my business, I don't know why, to engage with the pathologists and, you know, have them treat me and us as equals and them as partners. And three or four of them became very close professionally. And Jim Weston, who was the medical examiner for San Diego County, I did some consulting work from San Jose with him. And also worked with him in the American Academy of Forensic Sciences toxicology section. Anyway, he left San Diego and he went to Utah as the state medical examiner for the whole state. And he had positions at the university, the faculty positions. And he called me in California and he said, I need you to come to Utah. I said, you got to be kidding. Leave California to go to Salt Lake City? He said, well, here I am, the state medical examiner, and the only lab I have is the state health laboratory. And they don't know forensic toxicology at all. And there's an opportunity to set up a toxicology laboratory group in the university as part of the College of Pharmacy and Medicine. Anyway, I went out there, gave a couple of seminars, got wined and dined and all those good things, and seduced to go to Salt Lake City. And everybody thought I was nuts. But at the time, in 1973, I had been invited to go to Brazil to teach. And it was not good times politically in Brazil at that time. And I went to the university at Sao Paulo and taught for a whole semester. And it revolutionized my thinking, because that was where I first started to realize the gap, and opportunity gap, resources gap between developing countries and we privileged developed countries. Anyway, I was not going to give up that opportunity, but I had to leave my job in California to go do it. And I actually went a second time and to set up mass spectrometers. That's another part of my life in those countries. And I've been, as a result, in every country except Venezuela, doing that. So I told Utah that I was going to go away for 3 months to Brazil. And when I came back, I would come to university, which I did. And they wanted to set up a center for human toxicology. It was at a time when, in the United States, toxicology was getting a lot of notice. Environmental, the EPA was being set up, other regulatory agencies, the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, nothing to do with forensic toxicologists, I knew it, but there was money. And the university saw that if we had a research arm called toxicology, we could bring in research money. And of course, that was their motive. But the motive for Jim Weston, the medical examiner and a professor in pathology, was to develop a forensic toxicology lab that would service him. And that laboratory provided service work on a consultant basis, as well as for the state. We helped train the scientists, very good people, at the State Health Department to work in the area of toxicology. And we did research, of course, and the research was funded largely by pharmaceutical companies. I had money from Eli Lilly to work on the problems of propoxyphene. I did two big cases in Australia on propoxyphene. There was very interesting death in a prison inmate in Perth. And it became quite notorious, and we were involved in that. So okay. The center provided these kind of services, teaching, of course, research. But a caveat to this, a condition that I asked for, was I wanted to complete my PhD. I had done a lot of work towards it, but I'd never completed it. I'd never had the resources and money to go to university full-time. I was part-time when I was at Scotland Yard, and then did other things when I was in San Jose. And so I took all the entrance exams. And so, on, long story short, I completed my PhD late in life.
Yeah, okay.
In 1977 at the University of Utah. Then, one day, I'm sitting at my desk doing nothing, and the phone rings. And the phone says, my name is Michael Ross, and I'm with a small company in the Bay Area, California. You've probably never heard of us. It's called Genentech. And we are trying to make drugs, therapeutic agents, out of human proteins. And we're using recombinant DNA techniques, which were in their infancy.
This would have been really early on, wouldn't it?
Oh, really early. The Genentech was founded, I think, 1978. This was 1983.
Wow.
So they were in a Quonset hut on Oyster Point near the airport on the bay. Anyway, so they said that they had been to the FDA and told them that they were making these drugs and what did they need to do, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the FDA said, well, you need to have safety and toxicology studies. And they said in their arrogance, hey, these are perfect replicas of human proteins. How can they be toxic?
Exactly.
Anyway, they had
It can't go wrong.
But as we know, pharmacology is not the natural situation. Anyway, they had done some studies, early studies, with gamma interferon. And in rhesus monkeys and cynomolgus monkeys, and they got some terrible results. And so they said, would you come out and give us a couple of seminars on what we should be doing? You know, we want to be a pharmaceutical company. God knows if that's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And so I did. And at that time, in 1973, I was due for a sabbatical leave from the university and the center. And I really wanted to take it. So Genentech said to me, why don't you come here and do your sabbatical for a year? And I was very enthusiastic because I could see that these techniques of recombinant DNA and gene therapy was likely, and I knew nothing about it. My understanding of cell biology was rudimentary. And so I told the university I was going on a sabbatical, and that's where I was going, and that's what I was going to do. Well, the university in Genentech, because it was not another university, which was usual to go to for a sabbatical, it was a company. And so they got into a fight about who was going to pay me. So Genentech said, hey, we're not going to fight. Just come here. We'll put you on the payroll, and you can go back to the university anytime you want to fulfill any obligations. And so I went to Genentech, and I was appointed as the director of preclinical pharmacological sciences development. And I inherited, I think, about 15 people to start the department. And when I left 9 years later, I had 127.
Wow.
And we'd put four drugs on the market. So it was a fantastic time, but extremely stressful.
Right.
We didn't know month to month that we were going to survive. You know? Funding, it was venture capital money, but it was a fantastic experience. Many of the scientists have won international awards for their discovery science and research. You may have heard of the drug now called Herceptin. It's the HER2 humanized antibody for treating breast cancer. And we did that. And the scientist who discovered that suppressor gene was in my department, Mike Shepard. So a lot of really good things. The first drug I did, funnily enough, and was brought to fruition was human growth hormone.
Right.
And at that time, no thought was given about anti-doping.
Yeah.
And that was far in my future. But yet there I was developing and doing all the preclinical work that went into the eventual approval of Protropin. And, of course, it was for hyperpituitary dwarfs who were deficient in growth hormone. And we distributed it through the American Pediatric Endocrinology Society.
Yeah.
But since then, it has gone out into all kinds of other indications, clinical indications, not all of which I approve. But the other big drug was TPA, tissue plasminogen activator, for critical thrombus, cardiac arrest.
Yeah. Yep.
And if you get to the patient within 90 minutes, that will dissolve fibrin clots. It has not been as successful. It's been successful, but not as successful as hoped. It's expensive, and streptokinase was a big, much cheaper alternative. And it's fibrin specific. So if you have a platelet-rich thrombus, It's not a lot of help.
Okay.
And of course, it dissolves or resolves fibrin wherever it finds it. And so there's a danger of bleeding in unwanted places, including the brain. That has not proved to be, but it was a big worry at the FDA.
Yeah, fair enough.
Anyway, I did that until 1990, and it was a wonderful experience. But I slept at the company. It was just a life.
It was hard, very hard work by the sound of it.
Very hard work.
High pressure.
And very competitive. We brought in really top-notch young scientists. Brilliant. But they were ambitious and aggressive and had to be controlled and managed. And it was a real challenge. But the product was remarkable. It was quite remarkable.
So when you were mentioning human growth hormone, prior to that, there would have been isolations of human growth hormone from animals, I guess.
There were two sources of growth hormone for these children at that time. One was from cadavers. The City of Hope Hospital in Los Angeles had a contract with the federal government to extract human growth hormone from human pituitaries. They also had a contract to use bovine growth hormone, which had many problems, particularly the immune response to a foreign protein. And the extracted, although they did a very remarkable job for the time of purifying the protein from human cadavers, it was not fully pure.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that our drug, the human growth hormone that we developed at Genentech, was approved, and Eli Lilly's product was approved very quickly after that, was approved because there was an outbreak of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, prions, which at the time had been thought to be confined to sheep, but had transferred to humans. And one of the vectors for transferring it turned out to be this cadaveric human growth hormone.
Yeah, and I do remember that. I do remember that period. It was very tumultuous in terms of even people who were coming back from the UK and other places where they might have been exposed to the.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true. And the big toxicology problem for human proteins and growth hormone served as a prototype in many ways was what would be the immune response to a pharmacological dose of a protein?
Yeah.
Would we develop antibodies? And would those antibodies be neutralizing? Would they neutralize the drug? And cause long-term side effects. It turned out that that was not a problem with our, even though our human growth hormone, to be fair, actually had an extra methionine amino acid in it. We eventually figured out how to get rid of that, but we made it in E. coli bacteria.
Amazing.
And it was a question of how to get the drug once it was made by the bacteria out of the cells and purified and so on and made into a pure drug. And we realized we were losing a lot in the intercellular membrane. There are two membranes to the E. coli, and it would expel it. If we crushed the whole bacteria cell, it was a mess to purify. So we wanted to find a way to get the cell itself to expel the growth hormone, and it would only expel it as far as this intermembrane space.
Yeah.
And to get it out, we had to add a methionine. But eventually, these hotshot scientists figured out how to get it out. TPA was a glycosylated protein and very complicated. And we had to make that in Chinese ovary cells because of the glycosylations. That was all very early days.
You've made an amazing contribution there. So maybe let's go back to TEFT. You were present at the 60th anniversary meeting in London. and the ToxPod aired a live session featuring past presidents, including you. When you asked, what does TAFT mean to you, you mentioned that it opened up the world to you. Can you expand to us what it was like as a scientist in an international community at that time? I mean, communication and travel was completely different back then. Do you want to expand on how TAFT broadened your opportunities?
Yes, it most certainly did. First of all, within Europe, we went to European regional meetings, and I, again, personal friends. TAFT's amazing. We not only were collaborators and colleagues, the number of friends, true friends,
yes,
that I made. Manfred Moller in Hamburg became, he came to the United States many times, came to the Center for Human Toxicology. I went to his home. Hydra and his wife got to know, etc. And then something that I'm very quite proud of is we extracted, if that's the right word, Klaus Müller from Leipzig in the 1970s and brought him to the United States. And that was a real experience. But that resulted in me being able to go to Leipzig. And okay. I went originally. Another phase of my life was my reaction with Finnegan, the founder of the quadrupole mass spectrometer. He was in, may I digress for just a moment?
Sure.
He was in Palo Alto, California, and had started a small company called Finnegan Instruments. And the instruments they were building were quadrupole mass spectrometers.
Mm.
And I was sitting in California, in San Jose, 10 miles south, trying to figure out how to specifically identify, same old problem,
yep,
extracts, absolutely specifically, unequivocally identify them, and then learn how to quantitate them. And I had, another small digression, I had done some work with NASA at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. They were wanting to put, they wanted two things. One, they wanted to take NASA's technology and apply it to civil problems. And one of the things they hit upon was how could their technologies and computers, early days, help forensic science? But they wanted to put a small mass spectrometer on a probe to Venus. And they wanted to sample the atmosphere. And the quadrupole mass spectrometer with Bob Finnegan, who was an amazing guy, he was in the Air Force. He got his PhD in the Air Force. His PhD thesis was on aerial antenna design, believe it or not. But he had a problem. He was in science in the Air Force and part of education. And they were trying to find a way to monitor leaking gases from missiles that were in silos.
Mm.
And Bob decided that a quadrupole device, I won't call it a mass spectrometer, could be put in a silo and it could monitor at low molecular weights the gases that were fueling the missiles for leakage and safety purposes. And that led him to think, you know, this could become a real instrument and expand its spectrum of bandwidth.
Yep.
And the Air Force were not interested. And Bob being Bob, he quit the Air Force, came home to California, to Palo Alto, and started a company with three other guys, all three of whom were in the big high-resolution magnetic sector instrument field. So I, at this time, about 1968 in California, was trying to solve my problem. And I learned through NASA and Jet Propulsion that they had a mass spectrometer at a laboratory with Lockheed Martin in the East Bay of California, where I was. So I invited myself over there to go see what they had. And they had a huge Bendix time of flight instrument, very crude compared to today, but it worked. So Bendix said, with NASA money, we'll put one of our instruments in your lab in San Jose and see if you can make it work. So they did. And I and one of the smartest guys that ever worked for me in California, Taylor, was his last name, decided to hook this thing to a gas chromatograph. And we worked on all kinds of interfaces. But within a few months, we could show we could get a mass spectrum out of this setup. But I learned that Bob Finnegan, forgotten how I first learned his name, but I was looking into mass spec. And here was Bob Finnegan making these quadruples. So I went to, I met Linus Pauling through him.
Wow.
Linus Pauling was interested in vitamin C, amongst other crazy things, and a brilliant organic chemist, of course. And I turned up at Finnegan Instruments in Palo Alto, and there was Linus Pauling. But I met Bob, and we talked, and he said, I think our quadrupole instrument can do better than this Bendix time of flight monstrosity that you're working with. And so he said, we are looking for opportunities to get our quadrupole mass spectrometers into working labs. And, you know, what fields do you think? I said, well, the field of clinical medicine is difficult. It's massive. Hewlett-Packard have their fingerprints all over it. A little company like you don't stand a chance, et cetera. But I said, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency has laboratories all over the country and other government agencies. The Drug Enforcement Agency was just starting with having regional labs. And then I said, there's me in forensic toxicology. And I said, we need to put them. So he said, well, you know, how do we do that? I said, you've got to educate them. We've got to go out and give talks and demonstrate and show what it can do. But I said, first of all, I've got to prove to myself this is worthwhile. Anyway, the rest, as I said, is history. Wow. And that's part of why I went to Brazil and all these other countries in South America. So anyway, I talked to Manfred and later Hans Maurer at Homburg, and then with Klaus Müller in Leipzig, and then Hans Brandenberger in Zurich. And Hans, who followed me as president, was fantastic, a great chemist and scientist. Yeah. And he was very interested in mass spectrometry. The other thing was I went to, this was all with Finnegan's support, I went to Prague, and where, I'm trying to think of his first name, his last name was Kundala, very good toxicologist. And he had the responsibility of analyzing urine samples from professional cyclists. Professional cycling racing was very big in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet countries, as well as in Western Europe. And so he had a bus about the size of a school bus, and in it he had a lab. And he would follow the races, and then they would randomly select cyclists, take urine samples, and test them.
Wow.
And I went to see him. I was taken by a representative that Finnegan, I don't know how Finnegan funded him, Siggy Mueller. He was Swiss. And he drove me behind the curtain, the Soviet countries, the GDR, and then what was then Czechoslovakia, Poland.
Shall we set the scene back then? I mean, this is in a period where there's very high tensions across Europe and across the world. Going behind the Iron Curtain is no small matter, is it?
Well, it wasn't. I remember driving with Siggy from Leipzig. We were doing okay in Leipzig, and we were going to go to Prague. And we got to the Czech border, and in the trunk of the car, we had all this electronic stuff that were really spare parts for the guys in Prague. And I always carried a small quadrupole in my pocket. It was heavy. I used to give talks and I'd say, I've got a mass spectrometer in my pocket. And I'd pick it up, you know, in my talk. I said, this is quadrupole. So all this was in the trunk of the car. And these guys came out, you know, with guns and uniforms. And wow, we didn't speak the language. Siggy was fantastic. And you know what they confiscated? Magazines, newspapers, books.
Yeah.
And they didn't care about anything else.
Right.
But it took hours upon hours. And we were in a Volvo station wagon, and we got to Prague and parked the car outside the hotel, and it just was on the street. And when we got up next morning and went to the car, the Volvo badge, the hubcaps, it was all gone. It was all
amazing.
Gone. But yes, somehow the people themselves were so welcoming. You know, I formed a close friendship with Klaus Müller in Leipzig. Nobody will ever know what his real role was, although he was well regarded at the Karl Marx University where I went and lectured. And so that was why I first went to Leipzig. Oh. And then we decided to have a meeting there, a TF meeting.
Amazing. There. What and, year would the meeting have been?
1977.
Right. Yep. So
it was a long time before the wall came down. I mean, it was very much the Soviet satellite. But they treated us very, very well. But I think I went about four times into the East European countries.
Wow.
And it was all to... And that partly, this comes back to your question. This all comes back to opening my mind to the world. But it was all through TEFT and mass spectrometry. I had published quite a bit on early mass spec, reference libraries of data, and so on with my colleague Roger Faltz. And that got me invitations. Then I like travel. And so I had funds sometimes and sometimes private money. But I went on a scientific expedition to Antarctica. And I've been to the Arctic, I've been to both poles.
Wow, that's amazing, you know, Brian. Yeah.
And I would say my introduction to international travel wasn't so much leaving London and coming to the US. Although I love traveling around the U.S. in my car, it was science. It was the science and the collaboration. And TEFT were at the forefront of that.
Yeah. When COVID came around, of course, everyone realized we could have online meetings, but it's hard to actually articulate the benefit of in-person meetings when you can have virtually zero travel costs online meeting. But the benefits that come out of it are the interactions between people and the, as you said, the way you open up your mind, you meet people properly, you have conversations at morning tea. That's the most important thing about these in-person meetings.
Yeah, all the postdocs and grad students I've had, I've insisted that during their time with me, they went to one international meeting somewhere.
Yeah. You also mentioned at the 60th anniversary that members should start thinking about what they can give back to TEFT after all TEFT has given them. And I'm guessing that's where we can lead into the Brian Finkel Travelling Scientist Award. So what was your motivation behind supporting that so well?
Exactly what you said. I've actually got a note here thinking you would bring it up. And I've said I want to give back at least some of what I have been given.
Yeah.
You know, TEFT, as we've discussed and as we've read, is all about, its purpose was international communication amongst forensic toxicologists to educate ourselves and to collaborate and do what research we could. And then my travels to all the labs all over the world, I've seen how advanced labs can work, but sometimes that's tough. I mean, our labs in the United States are not funded well, but in comparison with Buenos Aires, God bless them, or Venezuela, or the Eastern countries, We have so much. And then, of course, there's a huge continent of Africa. I went to South Africa twice, again, treated wonderfully well, allowed to give lectures in both types of universities. And it taught me, just by osmosis, you know, the need for us to not just collaborate, but to help each other. You know, many of the labs have excellent personnel, but they don't have the opportunity to develop their talents. And that was another part. And then I thought it was a continuation, I hoped, of TF's purposes, that we would learn from each other. So the idea is, as you probably know, that a scientist, a mature forensic toxicologist from a mature developed lab, can go for a period of time to an underdeveloped and help them with whatever help they may need, or vice versa, that a scientist from a lab that needs more development and needs assistance can go to a fully developed lab of their choosing for a period of time to learn something. And that was my motivation and still is. And I'm very lucky, very, very lucky to have a little wherewithal in the bank in my retirement. And I can't think of a better not-for-profit organization to help.
Thank you, Brian. That really is a fantastic contribution you've given back to scientists all over the world. My colleague, Stephen Trobiani, was awarded the award last year to visit Suprani Pantanan's laboratory at the CIFS in Thailand last year. He was there for 3 weeks. And this opportunity, I was asking you about it yesterday, it's okay if you get a manufacturer can come along and install your instrument and put it on the bench and run a standard and they tell you how good it is. But as we all know, it's not as easy as that. And so for Stephen to come over and have worked for years on exactly the same instrument with years of experience, years of problem solving, it really does get those laboratories off to a very quick start. And the funding is such that he can stay for a long time. So he stayed there for 3 weeks, which is 3 weeks of not only science, but also developing both of their interactions with people from different countries. So really is fulfilling TF's principles.
I'll go on doing it as long as I can. I obviously don't have many more years on Earth, but it can be arranged. And I wasn't sure whether it would be successful, and it's still in its early days. But I think there's been three or four now.
Yep.
There was an Italian and Tunisian who was in London, and I spoke to him. He said he'd had a great experience. So, yeah. Yep. So that was the motivation, and I can fund it, and I hope it's promoted. I want to see it promoted within TIAFT.
Well, I think we might have to wind it up. We've had a wonderful talk. It's been fascinating. I have to say congratulations, Brian, on such an illustrious career. The contributions to our field and, of course, to TF itself, both in the past and moving into the future through your Travelling Scientist Grant. It's an amazing legacy, and thank you very much for joining us.
It's been my privilege, Peter. Thank you.
Registration is now open for the 61st Annual TIAFT meeting taking place from the 2nd to the 6th of September 2024 in St. Gallen, Switzerland. The early bird rate is only available until May 31st, so be sure to register soon for the reduced rate at www.tiaft2024.org. We look forward to welcoming you to St. Gallen for an inspiring, engaging, and enlightening conference.